All right, 115. We're going to get back at it now. So we're moving into the energy storage portion of our discussion. Spencer, can I get you to advance us forward? Excellent. So I took a look and noticed a couple of different of those that had their hands up before we broke for lunch have typed some stuff into the Q&A. Just in case you're curious or wondering for it too, we do have the ability to maintain and capture those questions in that Q&A format after the fact. So if there is something that off your chest you can get a chance to say for it, please throw it in there so it isn't lost, and that will be part of the record after and absolutely be considered after the fact. So thank you for your engagement, participation in the morning. Again, on to energy storage treatment options and considerations. Over to you, ISO.
Oh, sorry, getting comfy on my ball here. So I'm going to be giving a few introductory remarks kind of in the ISO, framing up the ISO's consideration for energy storage tariff treatment. And then I'm going to turn it over to Steve Waller, and he's going to walk through the options that we had previously identified back on March 13th, but provide a bit more context and background to those options. What we're sharing here today is information to try and get the discussion going at that next level with you. We don't have a recommendation or kind of a preferred option being presented today. We're just kind of saying, here's the options we've identified, here's the considerations that we have with them, and then ending off with a few objectives or criteria that we're thinking we'll be using to evaluate the options. And happy to have kind of conversations or questions along the way, and end it off with a discussion around next steps for this piece in combination with the rest of them. So in looking at energy storage and kind of asking ourselves re-asking the question, what should tariff treatment look like for energy storage? And kind of how are they a user of the system, or how do they bring value, and how as a market participant are they different from other kind of producers or consumers, and if at all, and how does that impact their treatment in the tariff? And so starting kind of at some really just high level statements, I think the ISO has put out, before I dive in, one other comment. The ISO has, as many of you are aware, has put out an energy storage roadmap that lays out kind of pillars under which we have to be investigating longer term treatment for energy storage, or how to ensure that it's integrated into the system effectively, and tariff is one of those pillars. So we're looking at tariff treatment for energy storage as part of the bulk and regional engagement. There are other aspects of energy storage being investigated in different pockets or streams across the ISO. And some of you are involved in those discussions. And internally we're coordinating, but the biggest part of giving these comments is to kind of set the context around storage as a transmission alternative for our discussion today. And so we're not, as we look at tariff treatment for storage, we're looking at it from kind of the full spectrum of storage capabilities of what it can provide. And yes, storage as a transmission alternative is one of the areas that's been of a lot of discussion in the distribution system inquiry, and ISO's put its position forward, and there are other parties that have put different positions forward. And we have no intention of landing that and solving that in the discussion of tariff treatment. There's a narrow piece, though, that we are going to be talking about here today, and that gets to if storage is providing a non-wire service, and in our lens that we've looked at it, it's in the case of if the ISO has identified a need that it thinks it can be met through some type of service as opposed to a transmission development, and we run a competition and And these are all in future states with a whole bunch of details that need to be sorted out, but we run a competition and storage becomes the selected provider. The considerations that we have here today is, well, how should tariff treatment or charges be applied to that asset if it's using the transmission system to provide that service? And so in that, I hope that we can kind of take just that small lens of the considerations of storage as a transmission asset. So as we go forward, many of you will talk about it, but the ISO did do a fair bit of analysis and had some research done by the U of C to look at tariff treatment for energy storage in the 2018 GTA. It was one of the components. And we've learned a lot since then. The ISO and the industry has learned a lot about storage since then. And so we're at a place where we're taking a relook. But as we take our relook, the position that we took in the 2018 GTA of having storage just have a DTS and STS treatment like other service system access service users is still one of the options on our list. And so introductory comments to get us to the discussion of options is we're looking at it from the two questions. First question being, how is energy storage unique? And this is one that I think we don't have a clear answer to. It does provide a whole bunch of, or a broad range of technical services. It can be operated in a broad range of states. It's not clearly a load or a generator or a load and a generator. But I don't think we have a good ISO doesn't have a good clear answer on that. But what we do, if we could go to the next slide, Spencer, what I think we do have a stronger handle on is our understanding of the energy or the electricity market framework in Alberta and the fact that we're operating under a framework that's really premised on an unconstrained transmission system on which an energy-only market is facilitated and principles of fair, efficient, open competition are really driving prices and costs for consumers to be at a competitive level. And in that, it's really premised on that the capabilities or things isn't the right word, the attributes that we use or that are needed to serve Alberta's customers reliably, they're acquired through markets or competitive procurements. And that's a foundational premise that and really under that FEOC component. And when we look at what is procured to provide that reliability and serve customers, there's no particular attribute or capability that can only be provided by energy storage. We've been operating the grid for many years, and the Steve will talk about the use cases that we're looking at as kind of the lens to evaluate, well, where does energy storage fit into Alberta's market? And how to ensure that in its treatment, we're aligning with the fair, efficient, openly competitive principles that really make the outcomes of our energy-only market on our unconstrained transmission system work. And then from that, taking and asking the question, well, how should cost allocation be for transmission costs be applied to energy storage when we consider kind of the products or the capabilities that they would provide into the Alberta framework and how they would use the transmission system to be able to provide those. And really asking ourselves, well, how do we make sure not only are we getting kind of that cost causation principle piece, but that we're also getting treatment that aligns with the FEOC market and ensures reliability. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Steve to talk through the use cases and the options.
Thanks, Nicole. I'm actually not in Mexico, but it's a better view than my dingy basement. So I'd like to first cover off, like Nicole said.
Steve, you're just a little soft. Could I get you to raise your volume a little bit and just make sure you're enunciating?
Yeah, okay. I've got this crappy headset that doesn't pick up the mic very well. So I'll try to speak loudly. Again, let me know if that quiets down again on you.
That's better.
Okay, thanks. There are three current use cases for energy storage. And we defined a use case as simply what are the high-level applications that storage could provide in our framework today. And we'd identified three of them. One in the energy market, and one in the ancillary services market, and another one in transmission deferral. And then we looked at those three different use cases, and then assessed what is the value that's provided by energy storage when providing this use case. Then we looked at also how is energy storage compensated for the provision of that use case. And then how is the transmission system utilized when that use case is being executed? And also how value is provided to the transmission system through the execution of that use case. And then lastly, who is energy storage competing against in the markets these use cases are executed in? When we're looking at the energy market, you can see there is kind of two configurations that have a little bit different treatment, and we'll talk about those. But from the value provided, obviously, when storage is participating in the energy market, it's one of consuming while the prices are low, and then providing that energy back to the grid when prices are higher, and they are compensated by paying pool prices for the energy that they consume, and then compensated again in terms of when they deliver that energy back to the market at the pool price at that point in time. So it's a price arbitrage opportunity that applies. Now with hybrids, it's a slightly different configuration where the energy storage resource is built on site with another generator, and they're using that generator to provide the charging energy rather than having that generator put that energy onto the grid directly. Now, again, the compensation still works the same, though it's just done on a net-to-grid basis based on what the inflows and outflows are at the point of connection. So that's how they are compensated in the energy market. Obviously, they're utilizing the transmission system, particularly for standalone, to charge from the grid, taking energy from some other resource that had generated, and then using that energy and using the grid to restore the state of charge of that energy resource. They also would use the grid to discharge that energy to provide that energy for end consumers. Again, with the hybrid situation, because they're using the on-site generator for the charging, it's really only the discharging component of the asset that is utilizing the system. So we also look at how value is provided to the transmission system with resources in the energy market. So it's the same as any other generator. A commodity is... it's providing a commodity to be delivered to I'll call it the pipeline to deliver to end use consumers.
I need to do this to you, Steve, because I know you just got we can't hear you. Got to hold it up.
Oh, this darn thing. Okay, I'm gonna have to hold this up. It provides a reason for the load to use the grid. It's obviously like any other generator. It's putting something on the grid so the load has something to use on the grid. Anyway, that's pretty obvious. Who energy storage is competing against in the energy market is all other energy market suppliers. So generation and potentially load response, because they both have an influence on price. In the operating reserve market, it's what the value that energy storage provides is the capacity to dispatch or deliver the energy when directed. The energy storage resource is compensated through an ancillary service payment, OR, and also for the pool price of any delivered energy if directed to provide that. The transmission system is utilized through the charge and discharge, just like it does in the energy market. And that charge could be through trying to maintain a state of charge through the operating reserve contract period, and then also the discharge when directed to provide that capacity. So again, the value provided is the same as any other OR provider, and it makes the energy on the grid a little more reliable. Who's competing for energy storage or with energy storage for the provisions of OR is obviously the same players, generation and load response. The last use case we looked at is around transmission deferral and the provision of a non-wire solution. The ability to charge or discharge, to defer a planning constraint, and also to address potentially real-time congestion need. We believe that the energy storage should be compensated through a competitive contract, as Nicole mentioned earlier, rather than through a inclusion of regulated cost. And again, we're not going to get into the debate of how compensation for non-wire service should be provided in this session, but there will be other avenues to have that discussion. How the energy or transmission system is utilized. Like OR, the transmission system gives the ability to charge and discharge. But how the value is provided to the transmission system is that the value provided is the ability to defer a build of additional transmission. And the competition in this case would be with regulated wires. Next slide, Spencer. So on March 13th, just taking it back to what we presented then, the three options were deemed workable within our current framework, and we laid those out. One is more or less a current state where charges are based on flows and inflows are charged demand transmission service, and the outflows are applied to STS. So just like any inflow and outflow on the grid, DTS and STS would be applied. The second option we presented was a FERC 841-like treatment, and I'll talk a little bit more about 841 in a bit, where there are no DTS charges when providing certain market services. However, there are still full DTS charges when not providing those services, and we'll talk about that again a little bit later. The other option we presented was the interruptible service at a lower rate. And this is where storage is off when the system is stressed. That could come either through direct physical control by the ISO and the asset is tripped, or through some form of dispatch control based on bids and offers. Now, these were just our three ideas. There are others out there. We'd love to hear from you on other thoughts on approaches for tariff treatment for storage resources. But for now, we'll work with these until we hear about other ones. So if you could flip to the next slide.
So Steve, we do have a question from Horst. Is now a good time to get that in your opinion?
Sure. Yeah, sure. We can do that now.
Get Horst unmuted. We'll get his question in here. Hey, Horst.
Hi, does my setup still work?
Yeah, we can still hear you.
Okay, excellent. Could you go back one slide, please? That's slide 58 for people on the phone. I'm wondering around option two. So the ISO is contracting for certain market services. What is the rationale to create a special solution around this instead of just charging the storage full DTS charges at all times and have the price of the service reflect whatever is necessary, I guess, for the storage provider, and that can the storage provider can use it to offset its DTS charges or whatever. And so instead of making the rate design more complicated, when it's the ISO actually paying for the service, I mean, if we're charging them full DTS, you would assume that they require a higher payment for the service. And so the money just goes around the other way, and it truly simplifies the tariff treatment.
Honestly, Horst, I think I'm going to cover that when I drill into details on that particular option.
Excellent.
But that is exactly the consideration that we're wrestling with.
Okay. Thank you.
So from this point here, I'm now going to dive into a little more detail on each of the three options, provide a little further explanation of how these things work and what we conceive them being implemented as, and also discuss some of the advantages and disadvantages of these options. And Horst has already raised one. Nicole had mentioned this, I'm just going to recap it again, that in the 2018 general tariff application, the ISO submitted and the AUC approved a recommendation for storage, which was exactly that, DTS for any injections into the site, and STS for any, oh, I think I got that backwards. DTS for any withdrawals from the grid, and then STS for any injections. The AUC, in their rationale for approving that recommendation, was that the application was reasonable. It was supported by current legislation, and it reflected their principles of cost causation. They also said that the usage was similar to that of dual use sites. And we submitted an AUC study that Nicole had mentioned, and they felt that helped support our position. So from a cost causation perspective, if energy storage is able to cause the costs, it should be charged for those costs. But unfortunately, in that hearing, no one filed any contrary evidence. So this portion of the application went uncontested. But we did say in our response to all that we would still consider the options and not make a recommendation to proceed with what we filed in the AUC application until we worked more with industry on this particular issue. So that's, again, why we're here for this discussion. So next slide, thank you. So system access service is charged based on how you use the grid effectively. Connections to the grid are for removing energy from it, putting energy onto it, but in many cases for resources, it's both. How much a customer puts and takes is based on the nature of the customer. And as you can see, a wind farm is a resource that primarily puts energy onto the grid and is charged primarily STS. As you move down to larger plants with station service requirements like coal and thermal generation, they are primarily charged STS, but also have an impact with DTS. When we get into the...
Just having a little bit of trouble hearing you.
Okay.
Those on the phone, we're on slide 61 right now, and just in a second, when Steve gets through this spot here, we'll get to your question, Robert.
So when we talk about self-supply and export, their tariff impact depends again on the ratio of their generation in conjunction to their load. Larger generator, smaller load. Tariff treatment, the cost leans more towards STS than DTS. And And then conversely, as you move through this continuum, DFOs with distributed connected generation trend more towards DTS, ISDs that are primarily pure load but do have on-site generation but never export, again, primarily DTS, and then of course, pure consumer load that doesn't have any on-site generation. So we also put storage on that continuum, and storage that combines itself with on-site generation as an energy storage hybrid could effectively avoid all DTS charges because they're not using the grid to charge. Storage could also operate in a trickle charge mode where they minimize the amount of energy they're taking from the grid over time. And then lastly, they could just simply use the grid 50% of the time to charge and 50% of the time to discharge. And that would be the energy storage full charge capability. But no matter what, the service you need is available when you need it effectively, unless you choose not to. Again, it's what the customer desires or needs is available. And when you need it, and no matter how long you need it for. So that's essentially how we plan. The only limitation is how much you can put or take. So you, as part of your contract capacity, you decide what your STS and DTS levels will be. So if we could flip to the next slide. We'll talk a little bit now about DTS. We're going to ask questions.
Yeah, let's get Robert's and Paula's questions here, if it's relevant. Robert.
Hi, guys. And thanks for going through this, Steve. I just want to highlight, if we go back a slide here to 61, maybe something like that. No, 60. That UFC study has been taken out of context by the ISO repeatedly since it was created. And you can go and talk to the UFC, the authors, and saying that the conclusion that the ISO has drawn from it is that, you know, storage is the same as load is not the outcome of that study. So I think I just want to make that clear to everybody listening that, you know, that storage, you know, the outcome of that study was not that storage should be treated the same as load. It was that if you wanted storage to, it could act the same as load. That does not mean they're the same thing. So, and that needs to be clarified, and we need to stop pointing to this study, or at least the ISO's interpretation of it. If we go back up to a couple of items above, there was a table showing values of energy storage to the grid. And one item here that I note is missing is a reduction in price volatility that accrues to the value of the system and the value of the user when you have energy storage participating on the grid. So this is the net effect of raising the floor price and decreasing the price ceiling because of the actions of that storage asset on the grid. And that's a net value to the system when it's operating in the standalone, just the standalone. And that could potentially be seen as a load responsive mechanism, but generally the load response that we have would not be participating at prices that energy storage would be participating at. And so you're not going to get the same creation of price floor for, say, cogeneration and must run wind generators. So those are my two comments.
Can you elaborate on that value aspect of who gets the value or where's the value created for by a reduction in volatility?
Sure. So I'm still unmuted. So whenever you have a volatile price, there is a cost associated with having that price being unknown to consumers and generators in the future, because you have an unknown. If you have storage acting on the system, it will act in very similar way to how a tie line would act, and that certain prices it will increase the demand and therefore create a price floor, therefore allowing generators to know that the prices will go to zero less often. And then conversely, on the high price side is where the majority of the value is it's going to act like a generator, and having an additional generator on the grid will decrease the prices. And so I think that's a value that accrues to the grid, and it's not as simple as saying it's the same as generation and load response, because it's probably closer to a tie line.
Do other stakeholders see and appreciate that same value that Robert's suggesting? I guess I have to direct who I want to answer that. Let's get Richard to answer that, UCA.
Thank you, Jordan. I just wanted to answer that question. Yeah, whatever that value is, it's definitely a value to generators in the energy market and possibly to consumers. But I don't think it's a value to the grid in terms, if you're defining the grid as the transmission system of wires. I don't see any value from that reduction in volatility to the transmission operator. I certainly see the value to the energy market, but that's a distinct and very different animal.
Okay. Thanks, Richard. I saw, let's get Paula and Travis involved. Steve, we might just jump into questions here if people are already coming through into it. So,
absolutely.
Okay, Paula.
Hi there. Thanks very much. Just a couple of things. Number one, can you go back to that UFC study?
And can you also state your organization, Paula?
With Solis Energy Consulting.
Thank you.
That study was actually only on, I believe, arbitrage as a use case. So I think rather than sort of reference it from a high level, I think we either need to dig into it and see if it's applicability, because I have the same opinion as the last caller, is that I saw a lot of issues with the study at the time, and I don't see how it's being now used for applicability. So I think if you are going forward to use it for applicability, let's stick it out front and exactly what it did and exactly what the results were. But rather than sort of just generally refer to it as a rationale for how you would treat the tariff, I don't think is appropriate. So I think let's spend some time on that. My second concern, and
Paula, before you go there,
yeah.
So we put this information here really just to be a summary of what come out of the last proceeding, and maybe what would be more helpful is to say, and this is not that you need to direct the answer right now, but more be along the lines of like, as we go through these options, what is the information gap that continues to exist that some such study would fill?
Okay, that's fair. The second point is that I know a lot of us on this call are on the ESLIF, and how is this, it feels like these things are in parallel and not necessarily connected. I mean, we're kind of, our next meeting is November 22nd or 7th for the ESLIF. How are you connecting these processes, or is the stuff that's going on in ESLIF not affecting this one? Because the use cases that were discussed, I think it was this week or last Friday, I think it was, are very different than the use cases that you've applied here. And so I'm just wondering, how are these two processes connected?
So we released these materials the day before the ESLIF, and their review of, I guess, ISO's use cases for storage within the current framework. How are the two processes connected? I think the Energy Storage Learning and Information Forum is a group that the ISO is leading to talk about kind of everything storage related, mm-hmm. tariff, operational requirements, market treatment, storage as a transmission alternative. Steve and I are involved. Steve was at the session on Friday, so it's a bit of, we're using that as an information forum to inform this. But we continue to want to keep tariff treatment for energy storage with the Balkan regional tariff treatment.
So in terms of the use cases that were identified on last, I think it was Friday, I can't remember when it was, are those use cases highlighted in here? Because those were the use cases that ESLIF, I keep thinking it's a liberalization front. are those consistent with what was indicated by Travis and myself in the presentations? So I don't see them as being highly connected.
Again, those use cases that we talked about in that session weren't limited by the Alberta framework and what we currently require services for. So there were all sorts of great products that storage can provide, but we're only currently paying for these ones. You know, it's the energy market, various operating reserves, but not all the ones we talked about in that session. And then additionally, the various non-wire services, but things like voltage support and we recognize that yes, storage can do those things. However, we aren't compensating anyone for voltage support today. And that's a different debate we can have in a different session. But what I was trying to reflect here are the current things we compensate storage. We could compensate storage for, and that would be the price arbitrage, any form of ancillary service, and potentially non-wire solutions.
And so how do the two processes inform each other as we go forward? Because it's a bit of a waste if the two processes are completely separate. How do they inform each other?
Go ahead, Nicole.
Well, inform each other in the sense that as it says, the Energy Storage Learning and Information Forum is an avenue where the ISOs tapped people that have said, yes, we'll come participate to share information and learnings to help expand the ISO's knowledge. No decisions related to any particular tariff treatment or market treatment or ISO rules will specifically be engaged on in that session. It's more to bring learnings to the ISO.
So, but then wouldn't the timing be better if this was issued after that meeting rather than the day before? Because then it's not informed by it.
I think that's a reasonable, I hear what you're getting at for Paula. My big takeaway, just outsider looking in for, is it sounds like there's a learning form that should inform this. The timing, it's a little bit off for you here. So let's capture that comment. I think it's very valid. Is there something else you wanted to speak directly to
the content? That's okay. Thank you.
Travis, then Dan, then Horst.
Thanks. So Travis with Power Advisory and also work with Energy Storage Canada. I'm going to kind of have two linked points. One, building on what Robert said a few comments ago on you know, the kind of, I'll call it the purpose or natural operation of storage. And really, it's not bringing new megawatts to the system. It's shifting and trying to make more efficient use of the assets. And so the example they give was energy only market, but I think the same can be applied to the transmission system and effectively down to any of the wires assets, which is how do you ensure that their utilization is pushed up as high as possible so that ratepayers who have funded these projects are getting the most life out of it. And therefore you want your tariff design to encourage that. So which leads me to kind of my second point. I think, Nicole, you asked, you know, what analysis is kind of missing? I think one is, under the different options, what is the end cost to customers? And if you're, since storage is a recycling of cheap, naturally recycling cheap energy for more constrained times, you're adding a cost when you're paying a tariff. And that cost is going to ultimately be borne by ratepayers at the end of the day. So it would be, I think, an important kind of analysis step to look at, if you charge storage, have a certain amount of storage on the system and charge it under certain rate design options or tariff design options, what is the ultimate cost that ratepayers are paying? under that. And again, with storage not being an end use customer, but just an intermediate customer on the system, how does that play out to the ultimate funders of the system, which is residential, commercial, industrial, and other customer types? So that's kind of the core of my comment.
Sounds good. I heard mostly comment there, not necessarily a question, Travis. Is that fair?
Not at this time. I'm still digesting everything that's been put forward.
Tune on your thoughts. I got it. Yeah. Let's go Dan, then Horst, then Ed. Dan, I think we have you live.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Just wanted to quickly support what Robert had said with respect to the U of C study. I think the challenge is that it's, and I know it's referring back to the 2018 process, but the challenge is that it gets referenced, and anybody that's looking at this document or subsequent documents that reference it could easily draw an assumption that it's something that's more current as opposed to a study that occurred, you know, 5-6 years ago. So the optics of it, if it's put in front of policymakers and others, is not good. The second point is kind of a framing around, you know, how an energy storage asset operates. And really, and I know this has been talked about ad nauseum in the past, but just for the sake of resetting, an energy storage system operates economically by not drawing upon the electric system when it is economically destructive or economically unoptimal to do so. So it is going to draw when the system is not constrained. And in the past, this has always been the argument against treating it as a typical load. In you know, many of the DTS mechanisms, such as even your non-peak charges, like your substation fraction, capacity, things like that, it's not going to be drawing on the system when the system is constrained. Second, an interruptible mechanism tariff, which I think we've talked about, and I think there's kind of a collective group of us that are all nodding, would be extremely useful to storage and would recognize those attributes. And I don't think any storage participant or asset that is providing a service onto the grid would feel slighted if it was removed from operation via its offers, which it controls. I can't speak for the entire industry, but likely not an issue with being removed by the ISO in the instance that there was a need to remove load for the sake of the system. So I know this isn't a question, these are statements, but I just want to reframe that storage is really here to provide value to the grid or to provide value to a service behind the fence. If it's providing value to the grid, you know, it should not really be viewed as a load. If it's providing value to a behind the fence asset and drawing from the grid, maybe that is a different, you know, that's a different consideration. But I think there's a need to kind of like open up the conversation to the different configurations, use cases, and applications of storage. And these are, as Paul has mentioned, you know, some of the topics that are happening during the ESILF. And it makes it difficult to have a fulsome conversation here without, as Paul mentioned, tying those different processes together. So okay. Thank you. That's all I have to say.
Thanks, Dan. And I really want to tie together what I heard from Robert, from Paula, and from Dan. I really heard four things emerge. Number one, you study, there's some contention around that, and there's an issue with it being maybe disproportionately using or honing in on the wrong type of outcome support. So I've heard that, caught that. There's a desire to see more linkage between how energy storage fits within the broader market system and the tariff modernization process. I'm sensing a bit of a frustration with the lack of alignment there for it. that there's other benefits that storage plays that aren't necessarily being reflected in here. And then lastly, and probably most pertinent to this part of the conversation, is storage resources would appreciate or look favorably towards some type of interruptible tariff rate to reflect the way that they operate and provide value into the system. So that's really my four takeaways if I was to blend together a number of the things that I heard for along the way. I see Nicole's off mute, so I want to hear from you, but I'm also going to recommend, Steve, that you go to slide your summary slide, your kind of pros and cons. And then we just continue to have a bit of a discussion based on that. So I think it's slide 69 is my belief. Nicole, did you want to chime in here at all? Or okay. Steve, is there a 1 minute a summary that you're wanting to provide on slide 69 here?
I was hoping to cover that as a recap of what I talked about already. So I'm just wondering, could we just, rather than jump directly to the summary, unless we're constrained for time, then we can walk through these.
I'm moments, more conscious of time. I'm looking at it right now and wanting to keep the conversation flow going. So maybe instead we'll just continue with questions then, and let's assume that people have had an opportunity to read. So let's go to Horst then. Horst, then Ed, then Dwayne.
Hi, so I would like to provide maybe a completely different perspective on this. I don't think it's the purpose of storage to provide any kind of services to the grid or anything like that. I think the purpose of storage is that it's an economic enterprise that makes money for the owner of storage through provision of various products, playing arbitrage and selling services, etc. So I think that's the fundamental piece. Storage is not kind of some altruistic player. Storage is a commercial enterprise. And I think it should be treated as such. And so I think it should pay the full tariff charges. And if the tariff charges are using appropriate billing determinants, then the tariff charges should be appropriately low for a storage provider. For example, if currently 12 CP we think is the right signal, and let's park all that discussion from this morning, but if it were the right signal, then storage can easily avoid the 12 CP, so wouldn't pay that charge. So we don't need to have a special rate for storage, because they can simply, if we have the billing determinants right, we don't need a special rate for this provider. And to the extent that they are providing services that somebody actually wants and wants to pay for, then they can sell the service. And again, we don't need a special tariff treatment for that, because in the cost of the service, the storage provider can simply kind of offset its cost to provide the service, which would include potentially tariff costs. So I'm not seeing really any rationale as to why we should have any special treatment for storage compared to any other market participants, whether it's load or generation.
Okay, thanks, Horst. Well, let's go Ed, then Dwayne.
Well, it's good timing, I guess, to go after Horst. So I would take the absolute opposite opinion that Horst said. I think that storage is deserving of a rate that would make it actually economic. And the other thing I want to talk about is just the conversation that storage is just like a dual use customer. And I'd say that that's something that we need to stop talking about. Storage's sole business is taking energy from the grid, storing it, and putting it back. That's how they make their money. Dual use customers take energy from the grid or generate that energy. Usually they generate that energy, they create a widget, they sell back some energy to the grid. But their purpose is to create their widgets and make money doing that. Storage is trying to make money just simply by storing that energy. And so they're totally different businesses, and they have to be looked at differently. They might at a high level look the same, like they're both sometimes taking energy from the grid and sometimes selling it. But when you look at the purposes of their business, it's completely different. So as far as having an effective tariff rate, Travis mentioned, how do you judge these three, and I agreed with what he said, you got to look at the benefits to the grid from it. But I think the other way to judge these things is, what is the effective rate that you're charging storage? So the ISOs, even the current ISO tariff, when we looked at it, did some work for Energy Storage Canada with Leonard Olley and myself in the distribution inquiry. And we did a model, and we looked at running 2019 prices through the model and saying, if you had a storage unit and you did arbitrage, what would the effective tariff cost be for that opportunity? And it was $130 a megawatt hour. So the current DTS charges, even with the current amount of fixed charges we're charging right now, made storage effectively non-economic on a standalone basis. So if we don't have a rate for storage, we won't get storage. Now, existing SES customers might like that, but for consumers on the grid right now, they're looking for value for their money. They probably won't. And if the ISO was a for-profit business looking at maximizing the use of the transmission lines and saw that storage could join the system and not create any issues, then of course it would make total sense to price to create a priced energy storage where they effectively will join the market and provide some payment towards the fixed cost of the grid. So I think those are the things you kind of have to think about. The final point, I guess, is that we've talked about a little bit about storage is more like an import-export opportunity. And right now we charge exporters $8 a megawatt hour for the grid. Well, that's a whole lot better than $130. So if the exporters had to pay a full DTS charge, then what would their cost be? And so I think we've created an export-type rate for a reason to make that somewhat of an effective opportunity for people to use, and storage should have that same opportunity.
Okay, thanks, Ed. Okay. Let's hear Dwayne, and then I want to hear from Colin Robb with Capital Power, then we'll come back to Horst. Dwayne, are you there? Hello, Dwayne. Okay, let's go to Colin Robb with Capital Power. We'll see if Dwayne throws his hand back up. Colin.
Yeah, thanks very much. I just need to maybe make a comment and respond to some of the previous suggestions around what the tariff is intended to achieve. And I think I would sort of support the characterization that Horst had provided earlier. The objective of the tariff is not to send a signal that will expressly improve or encourage the development of one technology over another by improving their economics. That is totally at odds with the FEOC market. So that's the first point. I think the second point is, when broken into, you know, the constituent parts of a storage asset and how it operates in the market, as we've seen through these slides and as has been discussed, there's a lot of analogs that exist with all sorts of different technologies that are providing all sorts of the same products today. And therefore, between those different technologies providing the same service, they should be afforded the same treatment. So I would leave it at that.
Okay. Thanks, Colin. Let's try Dwayne again.
Mute now. How's that?
We can hear you now. We're good.
Golly. And I thought I was, you know, if there's a time when your Bachelor of Science in Engineering is going to fail you, it's when you're on a conference call. So I think that the conversation can be made a little bit more crisp by stopping the use of the word grid and say, this benefits the grid. We take from the grid. We give back to the grid. Let's be a little bit more succinct in our language and say that this will have an effect on the energy market, or this will have a certain effect on the transmission system, which is a regulated entity. And because I hear the word grid and it starts to really blur together for me. I'm having a hard time understanding what part of the grid we're talking about. So, I think that storage has a place. It has impacts in both those places. It has an impact in the energy space, and it has an impact in the transmission space. And they're not linear. So, fundamentally, I'm aligned with a lot of what Horst has said, but I think that we can make our language a little bit more clear.
Okay, thanks, Wayne. We're going to go Horst, Roberts, and then Akira.
Hi, so I kind of wanted to follow up what Ed has been saying is, I think, first of all, when we're looking at transmission tariff, we don't care at all what the individual customer is doing behind that connection, whether they're creating widgets, whether they're producing electricity, whether they're heating the house or whatever else it might be. It is, from a transmission perspective, it's up to you what you do with the electricity or how you created electricity for use on the grid. So we don't distinguish among that. So, and we shouldn't. We shouldn't suddenly start then saying that, okay, this customer is somehow special, because then I say, well, maybe a petrochem is better or worse than an oil sand producer or whatever. So we're not distinguishing what the customers are doing with their connection. And then, similar to what Colin has just said, it's absolutely not appropriate to make any kind of customer viable through specified tariff treatment. If it's not economic to have storage, then it's not economic to have storage. So it's quite simple as that. If I can't run my furnace because electricity is too expensive, then I'm not putting a furnace there. So it is really quite simple there. We're not subsidizing any customer class. And then lastly, with regard to the services, it is entirely up to the storage provider to sell whatever service they think they can provide. If they think they can benefit the quote unquote grid through better utilization of transmission line, et cetera, then it should be possible to sell that as a service. And then they can charge for that service. And then they can see if they're actually competitive with incremental transmission lines. But that doesn't work if we already have a backhanded subsidy through the tariff. Each individual product and benefit they think they can provide can be priced individually and will have to compete with alternative solutions. So I think so far I've not heard any kind of rational argument, at least in my mind, that would justify providing a different treatment to storage compared to any other market participant.
Thanks, Horst. So I'm just going to do a quick time check. 2:13. I see a lot of hands up. I think we could talk about this all day into the evening and break out a bottle of whiskey along the way. We're not going to do that. So we'll take a couple more questions. And then if you do have questions, we'll do the same thing, throw them in the Q&A so you don't lose track of them and the ice cream determine how best to respond. What we are going to do is I want to hear from Robert. I promised Akira that we'd hear from him. And then let's bring we'll try to get through as many as we can, but we'll see about Ed or Paul after that. So let's start with Robert.
Hi, guys. So I think this is a really good discussion, and I think that I'm hearing a lot of things that I agree with from all sides, and I think they're actually more aligned than you'd take from the conversation. So, you know, first I want to highlight that this market is a construct, and, you know, we've created this market, and there are beneficiaries of this market, such as cogeneration and generation that is far away from loads. Transmission has been built out to the tune of $17 billion to enable that generation to participate, and loads are paying for it. So I want to highlight highlight that this is a construct and we got to be working from this construct. So within the current tariff structure that we have, we look at how can energy storage, economically participate, not altruistically, but to maximize profit. And that there are ways to do that. You can do that if you have import-export type tariff, or you can do that if we have an interruptible rate. And I think that really what is aligning here with the discussion from this morning is that some sort of interruptible rate for customers who are able to be dispatched off immediately by the ISO should there be a transmission constraint would be extremely valuable to customers who have currently invested in on-site generation or load management systems, but it would also benefit energy storage and enable it to participate and provide value to the system without being cost causation. It's not causing additional cost to be incurred on the system. And so I think that that's really where all of this is aligning, is that some sort of interruptible rate that applies to storage as well as flexible customers is required to enable this the operation of this market fairly to move forward. I think that absolutely energy storage provides different values to the system and it than other and I guess different aspects to the energy market to the last caller's comment than other products. It can provide different services to the transmission system, and definitely it should be able to participate and compete for those. And I think that having an interruptible rate would help us solve a lot of these issues and apply fairly to everyone.
Okay. Thanks, Robert. We're going to go Akira, then we're going to go Richard with UCA, and that's where we stop the hands up question. So Paula, Ed, if I could get you guys to type yours in the Q&A, that would be appreciative. So let's go Akira.
Can you hear me now? Hello?
Yes, I can.
Okay, thank you. This is Akira from TransAlta. I do want to disagree with Horst and Colin. I think that there is a place for considering like a storage facility being a full DTS customer, for instance, in the situation where they do impose the same type of future transmission expansion costs. But I think for the most part, the fact that there are no opportunity service contracts without a DTS contract, and because battery storage projects themselves can only utilize the contract value for likely less than 50% of the capacity factor, I think that the tariff design right now has no place for these types of assets. It's entirely contemplating a traditional kind of industrial customer or some other customer that has a very high utilization rate for a capacity factor on their contract, which is one of the reasons why you would hear Ed coming up with a number like $100+ per megawatt hour for the cost of storage, which I think is the barrier to entry. I think it's more than fair to be reasonable about the way that you actually consider tariff classes and particularly energy storage. And in some circumstances, they might might be exposed to the full DTS cost, but I think you do need to consider another category of service. And I'm not limiting that to just energy storage. I think that there are other customers that might also exhibit the same types of profiles that should also be eligible for that. And then on the other point about why you would even want to consider giving storage some sort of break on this. And I think part of it is the way that energy storage can provide its services from both that supply to the load profile. So for instance, if you're providing frequency response, the actual battery's range can go right from the generation profile all the way into the load profile. And so if you were to, for instance, stop them, the battery, from being able to or charge them a punitive charge, like a DTS ratchet, when they're responding or providing the frequency response, you'll just stop having those energy storage providers provide that service to you. So I think that there is merit in considering situations like ancillary services where you may not want to be charging them a DTS contract cost because they're only incurring that for the provision of that service. And in most cases, they would be doing it from the charge state, but for the isolated instance when they're being called on too frequently and then they end up having to go into the load state. So those are my comments.
Okay. Thanks, Akira. Let's go Richard Stout with UCA, and then we'll, if your hand's up, you can throw her into the Q&A.
Thanks, Jordan. I just wanted to take the opportunity, because it's a rare one, to say I agree with Host. And I just want to support what he says, that energy storage is about making money through energy market arbitrage, possibly sale of ancillary services like frequency response, and that's all great. Go to it. But that should work within the transmission tariff that is designed for other reasons, and certainly not to favor any particular form of end use. Now, having said that, I think there could well be some scope for interruptible rates that might benefit energy storage, but there's a really important qualification there. That benefit from interruptibles needs to be to the transmission system, such as relieving a transmission constraint, and not a general benefit to this, you know, vaguely defined grid that I heard about later, which is really about benefiting some other entity. So to the extent, I think interruptible tariff might be worthwhile pursuing, but as long as that benefit is clearly for the wire system through constraint removal, that sort of thing, that would be okay. But again, not an end use based rate.
Excellent.
So well done, Host.
All right. So thank you to the discussion, to the parties that had there. Again, I think we could continue to go through this conversation quite a bit more. Throw your questions, please, in the Q&A. Respond to the questions in the comment matrix that'll come out after this session 4-2. But I did hear a lot of things. If I could go back to something that Robert said, I think that there is probably, depending on the lens of view that you take to it, where the two positions and camps are actually a little bit closer than maybe we're making them out to seem as parties on opposite sides of the line right now. So good discussion thus far. Will not be the end of it, I promise you that. And looking forward to seeing what people put both in the comment matrix and put forward for proposals for rate designs as well. Again, also hearing a big uptick for something around if there was an interruptible tariff rate class, not specifically just for storage, but if that was a rate class that was developed, that storage would view that favorably. So good conversation thus far. As a time check, we are 2:23 right now. We're going to move into the technical clarity portion of the agenda. We had saved about 45 minutes for this in the agenda, which technically ended 23 minutes ago. So we're well off. What we're going to do is we'll say, is there any kind of technical clarity questions for it that people can raise their hands for or enter into the Q&A that we'll spend about a half an hour going through at that period of time. So what you can expect is we'll be finished here no later than 3:00 for it. So again, apologies on our end for running quite a bit later, but we'll enter this portion. If there's no questions, we'll adjourn at that point. So I'm just going to reset. I'm going to lower all of everyone's hands that's up right now. So if you do have a question related to technical clarity, the rate design, please signal that question in the with your hand up now. So Surendra.
Okay, perfect. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Good. Yeah, this is the question for LaRonda on the bookend option B. Or the bookend B, this 120 hours of CP, I wanted to hear a little bit more on those one, so I can really think through what it means to us. So 120 hours, so we have to pay $1,000 per megawatt for every hour that power we have used and how those hours are allocated between the winter and summer. So a little bit more things on the those hours.
Is that a question, Laronda, that that you can pick up and run with?
Sorry, turn my microphone off. I'm going to try to moderate the questions. So if I don't have all the answers, we've got Raj Sharma and Spencer Hall here. And Spencer's running the slide deck, so it might be a little bit difficult, but they can step in. So the 120 hours, we're looking for weekday peaks. So, and those are regional peaks. And if you're on at your region peak on a winter December 2nd day, the load at that time of peak would be charged, would be multiplied by the $1,000, and you add it up for the month, and that would be your monthly CP charge. And those would apply for the three winter months and likely three summer months. Again, these are bookends. This is up for modifications, but this is questions of what bookend B looks like right now.
And just the follow-up, Jordan, if I may. So those hours, regional peak, would they be fixed hours? We know in advance that in December, this is 6 p.m., or they will be as unpredictable as the current 12 CPs are?
Well, I don't want to comment on predictability of a region or at a weekday. I don't have a ton of information, but no, it wouldn't be time of use rate where you know here's the hour ahead of time to avoid. We need to develop tools to get an understanding of what the load shape looks like in regions so that you have that information. And you know, some of the regions look a lot like system demand, and some of the regions look a little bit different for when the hour of the day that they peak in those winter months. Is there anything else you want to add, Raj?
Oh, all good.
Okay, and sorry, just one more before I let go. So if the facility is big enough in certain region, and I'm worried about like our area, we are a very large load, if we are on as a peak, and if we're not, there's no peak. So you have to think through that there might be some region, then one or two industry, and if they are CP responder, whenever they are on, there's a seasonal peak, and when they're not, there's no peak. So how do you handle that scenario?
Yeah, there would be a value where you become a critical tipping point for a coincident peak for a region. I thought the regions are fairly large, but it's something to look for. And I don't have an answer for that for you, Sorindra, right now.
Okay. No, thank you very much.
Thanks, Sorindra. Let's get Robert unmuted. And if others are going to be asking questions and throwing their hands up, also, if there's a slide reference that you want to talk to within those slides, kind of 76 through 89, just let us know and we can flip to that so everyone can see and go through the same shared. So, Robert, over to you.
This is just a request for input data that was used to create those bookends, as well as the, let's say, the current scenario, so that I can use it in looking at alternative tariffs and maybe what a interruptible rate might look like. If you guys can provide that, that'd be helpful. If it isn't already.
Laronda, are you clear on that ask?
No, I'm not.
What kind of input data were you thinking?
So you're determining during 120 hours in the year, who's going to be on, who's going to be off, and what impact that has to the tariff. How was the data that was used to generate that? I think something around there would be helpful. Is that more clear or not? I don't know.
well, no, but maybe we could take the conversation offline, and then if we do determine that there's something that we can give you, we'll just put it, load it up.
Okay, that makes sense, yeah.
Well, and we're committed to giving Bill impact tools, so something where you could put in your shape and determine what your bill would be. As for understanding everyone's response to the tariff design, like, we've made some pretty broad assumptions here in our impact analysis.
Right. This is more for the rate design option that is requested by October 14th.
Okay.
Be able to do that at, like, to benchmark it against these.
Right. There's a whole suite of tools we need to get out to stakeholders, and we're working flat out to do that. A rate design tool that says if you have this many billing determinants, you still have to recover these many dollars, therefore your rate is this. That's fairly, you know, straightforward request, and we'll see what we can do.
Yeah, it's more around the total tariff collected under those different scenarios, so that there's those different bookends, so that we can determine what or remodel a different scenario.
Robert, is what you're asking for is the input data and approach that went into generating slide 42?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Or some subset of that, knowing that there's probably huge amounts of data that went into that.
Yep.
Well, and it's site by site, so we have to be very careful.
Yeah. Maybe by region you can do it. I don't know.
Okay. So we'll capture that as ISO's heard a request or an action, and that you guys will take it away and determine what's available and appropriate to be able to provide to all stakeholders.
Sorry, I thought we were talking about slide 39. We're talking about 42. Not the rate outcomes, but more the rate impacts to certain consumer groups.
Correct.
I think there's going to be pretty limited information that we can provide on this, given that it is site by site specific data.
Okay. Maybe just Robert, if we could get you off mute to confirm this is the one that you're actually referring to.
Yeah, it was the 42. Okay. Yeah. And yeah, I understand you want to release individual customer outcomes. So if there was a way to do it by the region or something like that,
or it requires a flow through of information to us and we just run it through our model and give you some output.
Sure, that could work too.
Yeah, that might be an activity when we get the proposals on the 14th, if there's a way we can do that before the session.
Okay, so maybe what the ask would be is, Carla, let's take an action to add a question to the comment matrix, if at all possible, on if it would be interested for parties to be able to present that shape in, and then we can collect a bit of view and information for that. Not to sign yet for more work or anything. let's get Colette unmuted. Hi, Colette.
Hi, yeah.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, I have a question with respect to the option B or the bookend B. I think if you could just move to that slide. I think you have the billed quantity charge kind of estimated at just over $3,000 a megawatt.
Sorry, which, do you have a slide number you can reference us to, Colette?
39 or 42, one of those.
Okay, 39 or 42.
Yeah, 39.
Okay.
So I see the billing capacity, $3,100 per megawatt. I think that's actually less than the current regional build capacity charge. So I guess my question is, if you're a site that has on-site generation, a dual-use customer, and you're running all of the time as a generator, and so you would still, under this scenario, avoid coincident peak, how does your cost increase 100%?
If you're a dual use site, you said, or are we talking specifically about the sites?
I'm assuming the 1500 megawatts of contract capacity in the high CP responder bucket includes a lot of sites that are dual use customers. So I guess that's my question. If how does book NB result in 100% increase in charges if you're essentially only using the grid perhaps in a planned shutdown or an unplanned shutdown, and the regional charge is essentially less than it is in the current scenario?
I think the regional is around, I think it's less than 3,000, but so this is a little bit more. But our assumption here is that those sites under that heavy 12 CP responders row are charged for 50% of those CP hours. Now, if you have a site today that avoids, let's say, 11 out of the 12 months of the CP charge, the argument would be that they could avoid more than 50% of the CP hours, and maybe that number should be down to 10 or 20% of CP hours. And then that number, that 100%, would change drastically.
So I guess then my question is, if we looked at the spectrum of customers that is in that top book and there, the heavy 12 CP responders, I'm assuming some might see, you know, much higher than 100% increase in charges, where others would see lower, and it's just averaging to 100, depending if you're more of an interruptible load versus more of a dual use customer.
Right. Our analysis showed just a number of sites that are quite a bit more than 100%. So it is an averaging. I don't know how those different types of customers would respond to 120 CP. I don't think they would be uniform. If they're avoiding 100% of bulk right now, I don't think they would all avoid 80. You know, it's really difficult to determine that spectrum.
Yeah, I guess my comment would be that if you have a generator on site, then your ability to avoid those 120 CP hours, I would say, is fairly high. Okay. If your load that is looking, you know, right now where you're really just responding to those peak hours, it's certainly not 5 days a week, and it's certainly not several hours a day that you would have to respond there, you know, to be able to even get to 50% of the hours. So I think this, you know, as it's presented anyways, would be pretty much impossible for interruptible loads to be able to manage in this book NB without. Okay.
You mean impossible for them to manage, or how some of generation, the impact may be smaller than what we've estimated here?
In kind of my first look at it, if you have on-site generation, the impact is probably quite a bit smaller than 100%. And if you don't have on-site generation and you're purely an interruptible load, your impact is going to be much greater than 100%.
Responding to 50% of the hours may be a little bit of an aggressive assumption.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if I think of every single weekday in the month, and it's going to be several hours a day, these companies just can't afford that lost productivity to be able to reliably meet that every single day. So I think they would be forced to look at another alternative, which provides a more reliable response, which is on-site generation. Especially if there's no visibility of this price signal. And as Surendra mentioned, if you're the 120 megawatt load, that as soon as you come on, you set the peak, you can't respond to, you are setting the peak, so you can never avoid the peak.
Yeah, I think these are all good points that we want to see come out in the modification or levers. If regional just provides not a reasonable balance of efficient price signals, then you would put forward that maybe a regional peak isn't what we'd be seeking. What is a more effective price or a timing signal that allows sites to appropriately adjust their load without causing costs?
Yeah, it's going to be very difficult to even do the analysis on this, because the data that you have that probably indicates what a regional peak even is, we would almost have to backcast it with out response from the interruptible loads to figure out when it would have been had they not responded, and if they're actually, you know, how much they're influencing the peak. So I think unless you recreate the historical record without the CP response from the interruptible loads, we won't be able to even do this analysis in a good way.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Rhonda, and if you could also state your organization, Rhonda, please.
Hi, this is Rhonda from Arcus Power. I was just wondering if you could clarify the 120 CP. Is that 1 hour in every 24-hour day within the 3 winter months and the 3 summer months, or is it any accumulation of 120 hours?
It's a peak daily load. So if you look at the month of December and January and February, every weekday there would have a peak in that day.
A single hour per day.
Yeah.
Great, thanks.
Okay, thanks, Rhonda. Let again.
Today, the coincident peak is a peak 15-minute interval. Are you suggesting it would be an hour interval or still a 15-minute interval?
Can you just restate your question, Colette? We just caught the halfway through, so I'd like to hear the whole
question. Okay, sure. So under the current coincident peak rate, it's the peak 15-minute interval that determines what your pro rata share, or like if you're on during the peak. Are you proposing that this would move to an hour-long peak, or would it still be a 15-minute peak?
Well, that's pretty fine detail, but it's a good question, Colette. It would be my preference to move to an hourly because all the data that ISO currently provides is hourly. And this is the one 15-minute billing determinant. So for simplicity, for clarity, for consistency, I think we should move to an hourly.
Okay, thanks. I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
That also sounds like that's the first time you thought about that, Lorinda.
No, really, I've thought about it lots.
Okay.
I just have to get support.
Okay. Surendra.
Yeah. Hi, Lorinda. Another question, I thought in the month when there is no, those hours are not accounted for, let's say April, for example. So there will be no CP charge in that month. We just only pay $3,100 per megawatt per month.
That's correct. I realize that creates a payment schedule of lumpy payments. So work has to be done to figure out what is appropriate in billing. As in your January, February, March bills would be higher than your, or not March, December, January, February, your March, April, May bills would be lower. So, but yeah, you're right, Surendra. In those months, we would want to send the price signal to optimize the system we built that they don't see capacity constraints or issues in those months, those hours.
And so you will also do some forecast your revenue requirements. You collect enough in the month that to compensate the month you're not collecting, right?
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, it's Colette again. So another question, the current tariff does have a small energy component. Are any of your bookends or your options considering having like $0 per, like a zero energy charge, or are you still thinking of having a small energy charge?
It's zero right now. There's been some issues with that classification in our current tariff design in determining how much, 92.8%, what that's based on. Want to move to something that's simpler and easier to understand, and we don't see the recovery of the transmission costs on the energy basis to be appropriate for that cost responsibility / efficient price signal.
Okay, thanks.
We'll talk to you in 2 minutes, Colette.
Okay.
How? Oh, how's gone away? All right. There's how again. No. How, you're just coming back and forth on us. How are you there? No.
It'll take a while to get it on mute button to show up here. So
we can hear you now. We're good.
Good. This is go back to the slide 39, which is Colette was talking about the $3,100 charge. So Lorenda, just kind of the, for my information, it is essentially calculated based on the total of the bulk system cost, and then you divide it by the regional peak, you get the 3,100.
Well, yeah, that inter-regional functionalization of costs.
Is that the bulk system, essentially?
Yeah, exactly. It would be that.
Okay.
So if you want to use bulk, but it's inter-regional, it's the cost that...
It's basically the portion which is more or less kind of the charged based on the 12 CP right now. Am I right?
The $3,100?
Yeah. The total dollar billion in terms of total dollar cost, is that more or less the same amount you recovered right now from the CP, 12 CP?
From the bulk CP,
just to say it back in case, to see if I understood it right, that you're saying that the cost split between intra-regional and intra-regional would be similar in size between bulk and regional?
Yeah, that's great. Which is exactly the question. Yeah.
Based on the way the rates played out. And
right,
I think.
Right. So, yes?
I think so.
Okay.
Rhonda, so, did you follow that or do you want me to repeat it?
Yeah, because the $3,100 is similar to the regional charge right now. And then if you take $1,000 a megawatt, multiply it by 12 by 120, you get close to what we recover through the CP and bulk.
Thanks for that.
So, yeah, I think, sorry how it was cutting out and I didn't know what I was talking about.
Yeah, how it...
No, it's communication. Just I have to just follow up on that then. So given this is trying to, like the idea of this kind of regional... kind of the peak system is trying to a proxy of the efficiency signal. And then like if we're looking at the previous slide, we have the trade-off of kind of the future saving of 2 billion against the sunk cost of 17 billion. So my calculation of the based on the 17 billion for bulk part is probably 11 or 12 billion. So should we, in the cost allocation to that regional peak part, should we use more like a 2 billion as a potential savings rather than allocating 11 or 12 billion kind of the size in that category? Just try to make that, like say this the efficiency signal is trying to capture the efficiency and the efficiency, the maximum it could be just 2 billion.
I think that we listed that as kind of one of the items on the list of modifications, and that might that be if that's something that you think has merits, something to bring forward on the 22nd for us to discuss with the group.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Hal. Colette.
I just wanted to ask a question to get a better understanding of the regional versus intra-regional. Do you have, like, are you considering like 240 kV, 500 kV system to be inter-regional or intra-regional? And do you have a, like a voltage threshold that puts one in one bucket versus another?
I'll let Raj speak to that just because they're starting to get deep.
So that is what we have right now. So 240 kV and over is bulk and below 240 is regional. So that is what we have right now. What we are trying to move to is something that is more precise. So we have asked our planners and engineers to really figure out which lines and substations are moving power between regions. So it's a more direct connection to how we see the system planned and operated. So in this particular slide that Spencer brought up, you can see the circle that is highlighted in green. So that is the line and substation that is moving power between regions. So it would be a more precise, you can call it an allocation or bucketing of facilities, which one is inter and which one is intra. So we will use our planner's judgment and experience and what we see in our studies to really create those two buckets.
Does that answer your question, Colette?
I think so. I guess what I'm trying to understand is there, if a customer is connected at say 240 kV, should they be sharing the same cost responsibility as customers that are connected at lower voltages?
I can quickly try to answer that. So as long as they are within a region and these inter-regional lines are moving power in and out of that region, it doesn't really matter how they are connected within that region. They are going to use these lines to move power in and out. So the type of connection or voltage of connection doesn't really matter, because your contribution or your stress or your flow on these lines is just a function of where, in which region you are.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Colette. Let's go Richard, then Surendra, and then Robert.
Thanks, Jordan. I just wanted to follow up on Raj's comment there. I agree. It was very much an earlier part of this discussion as to the fact that from a tariff design point of view, I think in the past we've been far too hung up on voltage level. It was more of a really an administrative convenience to say things happened at a certain voltage and not at another voltage. And I just got, this is the right way to go, to look at it more from a functional point of view, and to pay less attention to specific voltage. So I just think that's the right direction to go, Raj.
Thanks, Richard. Surendra, and then Robert.
Yeah, you can hear me now, right?
Yes, we can hear you.
This may be for Raj or Loranda. Go to 42, number 42 slide. The two charges, $3,100 and $1,000, these are the only two charges. And through these two charges, you will recover the entire bulk system charge and the regional charge. Does my understanding is correct?
I think we're on 30.
Yes, your understanding is right, Surendra.
Okay, and which one of these two is inter-region and which one is the inter-region?
Yeah, slide 39.
39? Okay.
So the intra, those facilities built within the region to serve customers within a region, that's a billing capacity or a sort of a more fixed type of charge. We really reinforce the region to be able to deliver capacity and reliably to customers, not so much your coincidence behavior. The what we used to consider the bulk system or the lines that are used to move power between regions, we see the driver as being in relation to how you behave at the time of stressed hour, and in this case, at the time of the region stressed hour.
And they could be two separate time for a given region, right? Because they have their intra region for $3,100. And $1,000 based on inter-region, which could be different hours than the intra-region, right?
No, the $1,000 will be based on your coincident peak at time or region peak, as describing the book MB. But $3,100 is times a billing capacity type charge, a more fixed charge, so it's not too different at times of.
Okay, so how, I'm just a bit confused now. So $3,100 is fixed based on your current billing capacity, right?
Right.
So then $1,000, there's only one charge, $1,000 per megawatt. And how do we use two criteria one intra and one interregion for one charge?
Well, we just, we have one big bucket of costs, the network cost, right? We're going to create two buckets based on the cost of the lines supporting your intra-regional and another bucket for the cost of the lines that move power between regions. Okay, now we have two buckets. And let's say one is, and then the bucket that we've now created that has all the intra-regional costs in, we're going to collect that using billing capacity. This other bucket that is the cost of the lines required to move power between regions, we're going to cover that through the CP signal. So that creating the intra is just creating these two buckets and how we recover the costs.
Okay, so so the $1,000 will get divided into another two charges again?
No.
Maybe Surinder, let me give it a go. I think if you look at the cost recovery column where we have interregional and intra-regional, I think you can look at those and think of them almost as like interregional is like the bulk classification now and intra-regional is like the regional classification now. And we charge the bulk based on 12 CP and the intra-regional based on billing capacity. And that will still go forward, but instead of it being only on 12 CP, it would be 120 coincident peak hours.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
Okay.
Do you want to ask another one?
No, I think I'll follow up offline. I think I'm still confused, but I think I'll follow up offline with maybe through. I'm missing something, but let not take the other people's time.
You can follow up with LaRonda too.
Sure.
All right. So these are going to be our last three questions because we're about 5 minutes to the end of our session, to 3 o'clock, to an hour past the end of our session. So we're going to go Robert and then Rand. Go ahead, Robert.
This is a question about in the bookend with the 120 hours annually CP. Would it be credited towards either DG or transmission customers that would generate during those periods?
Credited towards we are collecting a revenue requirement to pay for the transmission costs. So if any amount of that needed to also credit to generators, that would be a higher charge, right? I'm not recommending that. I'm just trying to, where we require $2.8 billion a year to recover our transmission costs. And that's the rate we've estimated in order to be able to do that.
So currently under CP12 as a DG connected customer, you can get these credits for a similar charge. Would that flow through occur under this 120 hours, or is that and if it does, would that also be applicable to transmission connected customers?
No, that's a distribution tariff item, right? So the DFO gets a reduced rate because of the generation, and then they collect the additional revenue required from their DFO customers. So it's a DFO rate mechanism, and that's not what we're talking about in here.
But this value is what sets that value is what sets the amount for that
credit
DFO flow through.
I think that they use the ISO tariff to determine that credit, and so if the ISO tariff changes, that credit would change.
Yeah, and so would there, you know, being this dissimilarity between DG and transmission connected, let's say generation occurring because of that value being one of the, I think, concerns with the current CP12, would that transfer occur to transmission connected customers if yeah. And I guess I'm hearing no.
No, transmission connected customer generators, they do not receive any credits for operating at any particular point in time. And that would be the same as it is now.
So we're not solving that problem. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Robert.
Which problem was that? Sorry. Can I ask a question?
I think he's.
Yeah. I think it was in one of the previous slides that there's a mismatch between distribution connected generators and transmission connected generators, because distribution connected generators can collect this CP12 credit, and transmission connected customers cannot. And if it's a regional billing determinant versus a grid wide, it's setting it up similar to a nodal type. Like, it's not a nodal price, but it's a nodal price signal. And so would there be an ability for that generator to collect that? Maybe this is out in the weeds. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm going to step in.
Go to the next one.
Yeah, I'm going to step in. So we promised Randy we'd hear from you. You're going to be our last question for today. So let's get Randy unmuted, and we will adjourn after this.
Yeah, just a couple of quick points on the idea of a regional peak. I have a hard time seeing any value in it for a couple of reasons. First, especially as we gain more and more intermittent renewable generation, you can have 1,000 megawatt swing in flows north-south, depending on the state of generation, even when if you want to call it a regional peak, two consecutive regional peaks could have completely different transmission flows simply because of that variability. The operation of the HVDC lines can swing those flows by hundreds of megawatts. And on top of that, any definition of regional is going to be highly subjective. Another point is if you change the flow on a single bulk transmission line, you can dramatically change the regional flows or the flows on all of the other on the lines in the region as well. So I think there's a lot of problems with the idea of regional. I guess the other observation is that if you're going to allocate costs based on bulk and regional, then do customers in region A get to share in the costs of region B? Because if you build the dollars into the rate, you're mixing the cost for region A into customers in region B that can't possibly affect it regionally one way or another. And I think that's a problem as well.
All right, just thanks. To be clear, we're not creating regional buckets, right?
Well, yes, I'm clear that you're not creating regional buckets, but you're trying to create regional incentives. And so those two things are at odds with each other.
Okay. Got it.
Okay. Thank you, Randy. All right. So we're going to adjourn 3:03. Anything that Carla, Nicole, you guys want to say in closing?
Thanks very much. Apologies that we went over a whole hour in our planning. We are hesitant to get people to sit in a virtual meeting for the whole day, but we covered a lot of great content here today and had a lot of good discussions. So thank you.
And Nicole and Jordan, I did set up, I think, a second poll. It was added during the session, so we could try again just to do that same poll. Nope. No, it isn't. Not.
Looks like it's live now.
Okay.
Okay. So if there's people if you would like to participate in that poll, it looks like it's the same question set from earlier. So if you just didn't get a chance to participate earlier, you can access your poll in your system tray. Otherwise, thank you again for staying engaged and dialed in for the meeting today. We're going to adjourn and we'll look forward to hearing from you in the comp matrices and at the next session. Thanks all.
Thank you.